Session number 14806.
Eddie Murray, side 14.
Could you just describe what you know of the battle that took place between the
Langson?
At Langson, yes.
Well, it was at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock in the evening, when Nuranzoy learned from one of the Indo-Chinese personnel that during the course of this dinner that they were having, in, you know, having been invited by the Japanese, that the whole Limonye and the whole of the military authorities and civilian authorities had been taken, had been captured and taken into custody. And so he knew then that, of course, the next thing that they tried to do would be to take the fortress. And so Duranzoy checked the ammunition and the personnel and saw that everybody was happy and that there was plenty of ammunition. At least he thought there was plenty of ammunition. And he checked it all and had the doors closed and sentinels posted. And then shortly afterwards, they were being bombarded with mortar bombs, the whole of the thing. And, of course, then they attacked, the Japanese attacked, and the Legion kept them at bay until eventually they ran out of ammunition. Mm. I mean, there were thousands of Japanese. And so they ran out of ammunition, and Duranzoy, in order, as he thought, to save lives, surrendered to the Japanese. And then the next morning they were led outside. They were fighting for about 11 hours, you know, without any food.
What strength of people we're talking? That's a company strength engagement on the French side?
Strength, on the French side, the Legion side, I suppose there must have been about perhaps 30
right.
People,
yes,
and including the lieutenant, and then they stepped outside, and there they were, and facing them were a couple of machine guns. This is early in the next morning, and so Duranzoy saw this, and he thought that it would be impossible that they would start, massacring them. Nevertheless, he stepped forward and he spoke to the Japanese lieutenant who was there. He might have been a captain, Japanese officer, who had a saber raised, do you see? And so Duranzoy saw that it was really serious. And so he stepped forward and he spoke to the officer who spoke French, and he said, well, you know, these soldiers are under my orders, so I'm the person responsible. Shoot me if you like, but leave them. And the Japanese officer shook his head, do you see? And so Duranzoy stepped back to be in front of his legionnaires, and then he stuck his head up very high indeed, and he started singing the Marseillaise. And of course, as soon as he'd started singing the Marseillaise, his other soldiers, you see, joined in with him. And then the saber came down, and these two machine guns rattled off until there was nobody living. One person, I think there was an NCO, who escaped to tell the whole story eventually. And what, 3 or 4 years ago, he was still alive and living in Paris. But that was the awful story that, of Langson, which was called Brière de Lille. And Brière de Lille, of course, was the original composer of the Marseillaise. He did it during a night.
Yes, yes. And so you mentioned also briefly of sort of somebody who had landed their plane and hit the perimeter, and he was in hospital.
Oh, that was at Kim Dae.
Oh, what happened
at
there?
Kim Dae. Well, I'm sure it was Lagan Muller, who got married to a personal friend, who was in the administration in Hanoi, and I went to the wedding and that sort of thing. But later on, just before
he was
the
a
Japanese,
flyer.
He was a yes, he was an airman, and they had always had a bet on at Kim Dae. Which was the airfield was of course built on a sort of a plateau, and they had a raffle or a bet on to see who during each month could land the potes. These are the biplanes, with attached to undercarriages and all the rest of it, dating back to the 1914 war, and these. To see who could land the closest to the perimeter fence, if you like, or the perimeter white line. And he was unfortunate because just a couple of days before this Japanese attack, he tried to land as near as possible to the white line, and his wheels caught in the edge, and of course the plane somersaulted, and he was badly injured and taken to Lanesan Hospital in Hanoi, where he was when the Japanese attacked. And the Japanese went to Lagenmuller, this RAF, this French Air Force pilot, and asked for information, and he refused to give any information at all. I don't suppose he'd have a lot of information anyhow, but they tortured him to such an extent that he expired there.
Mm-hmm.
And that again, you see, was the Japanese way of going about things.
Mm.
And his widow eventually married an admiral, as a matter of fact, right opposite the not the Luxembourg, yes, the Luxembourg Gardens in Paris.
Really? Yes.
And lived there. My wife and I went there a couple of times to see them.
Mm. Okay. And really, they went into almost every establishment and shot or brutalized anybody that they came across. It seems like
outside of the native population.
Mm. Mm.
Any European, of course, was, you know, I suppose, well, yes, they were, there was quite a high percentage of the European population that was decimated.
Mm. So the column, the idea of the column was to conduct mobile warfare, or whatever you want
well,
to call
it. Well, they knew it was going to be a retreat. It couldn't be anything else but a retreat. And they knew that also, Alessandri knew that he had to keep off the main, off the roads, the metal roads, because the Japanese had all these possibilities of transport and revictualling and all the rest of it, and carrying of new troops. And so Alessandri knew that he had to take the narrow paths along riversides and up over mountains and mountain passes to get to China. And he wasn't going the at first we went in the direction which he thought, I suppose, was the quickest way.
What's the distance? How many people were in this column?
2,000.
2,000, and that composed of legion and colonial troops.
Yes.
And there were a certain number of native troops as well. Any civilian dependents or civilians that decided to come out?
Not to my knowledge. I never found any.
No.
But as far as the native troops were concerned, not very long after having left Tong, Alessandri decided, of course, to dispense with the native troops because of the victualling situation. They would be able to survive in the native, in the villages and all and that sort of thing, and get back to their native homes, shall we say.
Without becoming involved in
the Japanese lot.
Yes. What were... You didn't have any vehicles?
No, we had no vehicles. No. We had a few mules carrying the 81 mortars. The 60 mortars, of course, were carried by the servants. And
when you say servants?
When I say servants, I mean those that served the mortar.
The crew.
The crew, yes.
Right.
Yes, the crew.
Mm.
And... the mules also carried ammunition and food supplies. And
you had the machine guns?
We had not many, three or four heavy machine guns.
Heavy machine guns, right.
And then at a certain distance from Tong...
And none of these cannons and so forth?
No. Mortars.
Yeah, mortars.
And then the 81 mortars we dispensed with, you know...
Too heavy.
As quickly as possible because they were too heavy.
Mm. And... how far was it from where you were to the direction you're going was China?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how far as the crow flies would that have been?
As the crow flies, I'd have thought, as the crow flies, maybe 600 miles.
And what about did you have a few rations? But I mean,
we had more or less iron rations.
Yes.
You see that we were carrying, and then the Americans came across several times, dropping us their P rations or K rations,
uh-huh.
And which were, you know,
these were canned rations, were they? Or I never tasted them.
Yes, Yes, they were canned rations, that's right.
Okay.
But there were also quite biscuits and coffee and things like this.
What did you do for water?
Water, well, most of the time, quite a long time, you see, we went along paths that were along the along rivers.
Mm.
And so, of course, yes, there was plenty of water most
but
of the time.
But I mean, for purification and so forth?
No purification. No,
didn't bother.
No, they were mountain streams,
you
see, which were very, very clean indeed.
Right. And I don't know whether they have a wet season or a dry season, but
they do indeed. There's a monsoon.
What was the season and how was the going? Wet, dry, dusty,
cold? Well, in the month of March, we had the winter rains intermittently, you see, with very, very sunny weather.
Rain and sun. Yeah.
You know, when you've got the Japanese at 100 yards, 200 yards behind you all the time, you
keep on going.
Just don't think of that sort of thing,
you see.
And as far as the landscape is concerned, you see it without seeing it. What you do see is possible refuge, possible places for placing a group to face the Japanese coming up behind you.
Mm.
And that sort of thing, you know. I know that we had burning sun.
Mm.
I know that we had awful storms, you see, and electrical storms too we had.
And you were climbing up mountains up to a considerable height, were you?
Between 5,000 and 8,000, some of the passes that we went up. And you realize that most of the time, the boots that we were wearing or the sandals that some of them were wearing, because some of them thought that we were just going outside of Tong to establish a strong point, do you see? And so some of them were only in their sandals. They hadn't had time to put the boots on or something like that, you know, for various reasons. And the colonial troops were exactly the same, do you see? They didn't know that we were really on our way to China, you know. I was one of the few that realized, and I was able to prepare myself, you know, correctly and put myself on complete, you know, dress myself completely.
And so how long in all did the march take to China?
Well, it took us 53 days to get to the Chinese frontier at Ma Li Tao. And during which time we had 16 pitched battles with the Japanese, and then of course the rest of the time was always skirmishes and avoiding ambushes and preparing ambushes. And you know, as far as the état-major, the command
staff,
the command section of which I was a part, you see, was concerned, we had to go out and get information, you know, stand on, climb up to high prominent parts, to look behind us and look to the side and look in front if we could, to see where the Japanese were, see if we could detect them.
And did you have radios?
There was. You see, it was not radio terrain in the mountains. You know, it was. It was quite ineffective, but we had a radio. Massignac had the radio, and we had contact. Eventually, you know, after a day or two, the 1st Battalion branched off to the right, shall we say, and the 3rd Battalion went to the right, and the 1st Battalion went to the left, and we went ahead, mainly because of the Wittling thing, do you see? Because we might have two or three villages straight ahead, but we wouldn't be able to get. And what's more, as soon as military were approaching these villages, the villagers disappeared into the mountains with all their pigs and their chickens and all the rest of it. And then we had to find the chief and show him the gold with which we were going to pay for the victuals. And so, of course, we reduced the number of troops that was going straight ahead, and some of them went left and some of them went right. They also were going to find villages, and so the revictualling process would be so much easier.
So you're about, so you're three battalions, 650 people in each battalion, presumably. And so on what sort of front, if I can put it there, I mean, how far separated were you from each column?
Well, it depended, you see, on the way, on the streams that we were following and on the mountain paths that we were following. Sometimes it was just a matter of hundreds of yards. On occasions it was probably up to 5 miles distance. And, you know, quite often we did have radio communication. Mm. But there again, General Alessandri, who was way up ahead with his command post, and he was not going to take the trouble of sending a message back to Eddie Murray saying, you know, this is what's happening. We, as the fighting force, we were kept absolutely ignorant of really of what was happening.
Right.
We just did what we were told and followed our noses and the noses of the people in front.
So these battles, I mean, what would happen? I mean, there'd be, I mean, the Japs were chasing you all the time.
So there, where General Alessandri had decided that we could establish a strong point in order to let the part of the troops, at least, move further ahead, which would, of course, eventually permit us to move towards them more quickly.
So it was falling back on a position.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have the mines or anything like that at that time?
No. There were no question of mines. No. But they had mortars.
Yes.
And they used them very, very much indeed. We had mortars, but then we, you know, when we established these strong points, we could use the 81s had gone, there's no doubt about that, you know, after a very short period of time. But we still had the 60s, which were reasonably light, and we had, you know, quite a bit of ammunition for these mortars. Not a lot, but we had sufficient, you see, to form a strong point, and then the machine guns we'd put down. We had light machine guns, and then we had rifle fire.
Okay, so you've got some heavy machine guns as well as light.
Yes, but the heavy machine guns didn't last for long.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we couldn't carry the ammunition for them.
And
the mules, of course, they, as soon as the guns started firing, then the mules would disappear.
What was the... Did the Japanese have aircraft?
Yes, I remember seeing one aircraft, that's all. But they never... I can't remember them ever dropping any bombs or anything like that at us.
And, I mean, perhaps...
Because, I mean...
Maybe they didn't have the fuel or the planes or whatever it
was. No, the Japanese were so close behind us. Do you see that they would risk...
Bombing their own people.
Bombing their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all... you know, 80% of the time it was through semi-jungle and thick jungle quite often. And so it was, you know, very, very difficult to spot the enemy and the friendly.
And mountains, I mean, did it get cold? I can't imagine.
Oh, it was very cold in places, yes. Very cold. Very often we were going through, you know, thick mist and fog up on the mountains. But there, of course, and then all the mountain passes, of course, like they do in Switzerland, they just go on and on and on, turning the whole of the time. And you can see across the valley and see, you know, what, 10 miles ahead, 12, 15 miles ahead, the other mountain passes that are going up, and you know for a fact that you're going towards them, and that's the sort of terrain that you're going to encounter. And as they come around like this, you see on the left-hand side, shall we say, you've got a steep drop, hundreds and hundreds of feet, and on the right-hand side, on the opposite side, you know, I'm just, I'm doing the march again. I can see it. And up on the side, on the right-hand side, is this great wall of the mountain, and just this narrow, just wide enough to take a cart, you know, certainly not a big vehicle like a bus.
And were these paths, were some of them dangerous? Slipping?
It was just rubble, and, you know, they weren't tarmacked at all.
Right.
And there was always a ditch on the near side of the mountain, so that falling waters or dripping waters, of course, could be sent, could find its way down the mountainside rather than across the path, and so making it more dangerous. But the paths were very, very dangerous and, in, as I said, very narrow. And then there were so many of these turnings, do you see, and that's the way we used to progress, if you like, or retreat. We would, one section would be behind a protuberance.
An outcrop.
An outcrop, yes. And we'd be there watching the last outcrop, do you see, and as soon as the Japanese put their heads around there, then the group, of course, would get fire with the light machine guns and rifle fire. And then they would duck their heads down, and then after, you know, after a little while, then the section that, or the group that had been there would retire as well. And in the meantime, two or three outcrops ahead, another group would be in position, and so that's the way we did it.
Okay. I was going to ask you, these on these paths, I mean, if you were the first few through, they'd be quite firm, presumably. But if you're on the last few through, I mean, they might have almost totally disintegrated with 600 or 2,000 people.
No, no. You know, to my recollection, the path was always quite firm.
Right.
Quite firm.
These paths had been made...
Probably by the Legion.
By the Legion?
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay. And, right. But did they not have the opportunity of outflanking you simply by sending out...
By
metalled road?
Yes. But remember that we had other detachments on the right and on the left. And so they were flanking parties, if you like. And they tried to keep in touch by radio. And I'm sure they did most of the time have radio communication. And they knew what the other was doing for quite a long time. Then batteries ran out, you see, and then it became much more difficult.
What was the sort of routine? I mean, you marched from dawn till dusk, did you? And
I think mainly the establishment of these strong points in different places was particularly to allow us to rest, if possible.
And but were you able to eat during the day or eat?
No, we used to, as I said, stop and form a strong point with one section or a couple of sections, you see, facing the enemy and another couple of sections facing the flanks. And another group ahead, you see, to ensure that there was no ambush in front. And then there, we'd build a fire, and usually there would be near a river or a stream so that we could, you know, have water, liquid refreshment, if you like. And the main reason, I'm sure, was to give us a time of rest.
Were you able to sleep at night? I mean, obviously you were to an extent, but I mean, how did that work?
Well, I mean, in the dark, the Japanese, you know, never took action in the dark.
Really?
No, I can't remember them at all ever taking action in the dark. Very early in the morning, you know, as soon as the first glimmer of dawn came, then they would attack us, shrieking and firing and letting off bombs and this sort of thing. But always in the morning and not during the night.
Really?
Never during the
night.
Did
they set up their own fires and eat and so forth? Or were you conscious of them nearby?
Not conscious of them. We knew they were nearby. And that's why, you know, in a group you'd have three or four that would be sleeping and three or four that, you know, would be on watch. And then, of course, we had sentinels and guard duties and things like that.
What did could you just explain about setting up these strong points? Did they actually dig in positions with
enfilading
fire and all the textbook stuff?
The textbook stuff.
Yeah. So they weren't in.
I suddenly realised that they didn't attack in the dark. And so the normal procedure of making a sort of a V, you know, for the machine gun, so that you know the area that you were designed to protect and all that sort of thing. I don't think that ever came into it. It was just a matter of, it was always brute force, you know, of getting as many rifles into a certain area, or machine guns into a certain area, to guard a certain access route. And we knew, you see, in the mountainous regions, and you know, it was nearly always mountainous region, there weren't so many roads for access, you see, towards us. And that's why, mainly why we were keeping to narrow paths, mountain passes.
So would people actually dig in and so forth?
Well, we had digging
in. So, I mean, you know, when you say these strong points, they'd dig in and they'd put down sections arcs of fire and so forth.
I mean, remember, we're in mountainous territory, and digging in was out of the question.
Yes.
It was more or less a lifting up, you know, with tree trunks and things like that. And we chopped down trees. And
did you destroy the path behind you?
No.
With demolition?
No, except as far as the bridges are concerned.
Right.
And I only remember going across two bridges. Mm. The first one we destroyed, and the second one we didn't have time to destroy. But there's no question of blowing up the wall of the mountain, for instance. There was also always the question of stragglers.
Yes. Come on to the stragglers in a minute, but could you just... you'd got these various weapons as described, and did you use grenades much and so forth?
Not many. I had four grenades. Mm. And, you know, I was one of the fortunate, I suppose, to have grenades, because each time I used a grenade, it was to my own advantage, or the advantage of my group or section.
Did you have submachine guns?
Now, wait a minute. In Indochina, when we did the resistance movement and went out for the canisters, there we had Sten guns. But there was... We knew at the time, and we found by experience, that the Sten gun was inclined to block. Mm. Do you see? And so they... And then we didn't have the ammunition necessary for Sten guns, but we had ammunition for our rifles, our 16 Grass rifles, I think they were. Grass, G-R-A-S.
Okay. And what armor, what sort of weapons did the Japs have? I mean, they had...
We didn't stop to ask.
Expect not. But did they have submachine guns or not?
Oh, yes,
in
they
the
had
jungle,
machine guns.
One side's got a submachine gun and the other side hasn't, and that makes a little
bit they had
of
machine
difference.
Guns.
Yeah.
We knew from the... And they had mortars. They had more mortars than we had. Mm. But, of course, the whole of the time, the roads, the national roads, you know, the tarmac roads, were never, I suppose, more than 10 miles away. And so they could always get
supplies.
fresh supplies, do you see, at least, you know, within 10 miles.
Did you set any booby traps and this sort of thing for them? Did you have, if you had demolitions
or
something?
No. There was only one thing that we thought about, you see, once we got on the go, and that was to get to China as quickly as possible.
Right. What sort of tactics then happened if they were following you? I mean, would they set up a mortar position and start bombing you, and then, or how would it work? I mean,
they were in exactly the same position as we were. We were trying to get to China as quickly as possible, and they were trying to catch us up. And also, of course, we knew that in all probability, they would be trying to work out in their minds what place we were headed for, where we were headed for, and then they would, you know, this turned out. I learned later on, you see, that they had started a movement, trying to get ahead of us to Mali Tau, but there were also several routes, you see, through the mountains.
So yes,
you know.
So your options were open to a bit.
The options were open.
Yeah.
Yes. Eventually, we took the right road, there's no doubt about it, because by that time the main roads had, I suppose, gone in different directions down towards Thailand, although we did go into Thailand and at Phung Sa Lee, but the We knew that that was their main object, of course, to get in front
of
us.
So you used a very indirect route, did you?
Very indirect route. Very indirect route. The most difficult, you see, and that was precipitous and circuitous.
So you actually went to China via Thailand?
Via Thailand, yes.
Okay. Let's just move over the tape.